Hi, so thank you very much for this opportunity. We're all very pleased to be able to present you a lot of results based on this database. So I just want to acknowledge my coworkers. I named just a few people here, but it's a big team. So those are the ones who are directly involved in this part of the study. So this is my disclosure. There's nothing, no relationship to state here. So just as a background, we have talked about that for the first two presentations. So child poverty is a significant public health issue and is affecting a large proportion of the population. Just to give you a few numbers, for Canadian children, 1 in 7 live in poverty. In the U.S., the numbers are higher, but along with Germany and Ireland, they have the highest poverty rate among industrialized countries. And when you compare that to Nordic countries, it's a little, the numbers, it's lower there, but it's still a very relevant, actual public health issue. So why are we interested in that? Well, poverty leads to restrictions in many areas. It leads to restriction in the choice of housing, in the neighborhood where you're going to be staying, so that's staying residentially, but also where you're going to be working, where you're going to be going to school, adequate nutrition, clothing, and so on. So there's many areas that are affected by that. One thing that has been looked at a lot in the literature is low income. But you can be poor and working, so the working poor, but you can also be in an even worse situation. So for example, unable to work due to any kind of disease or other kind of disability. And then after proving for a while that you're unable to work and being unemployed, then you get some last resort financial aid, which is social welfare, and the amount, like was said before by Lisa, the amount is way below the minimum needed to cover basic needs. So this is what we call severe poverty. In this presentation, what I'm going to be looking at is on the stress perspective of this question. So looking at poverty as a social stressor, and just to give you a little bit more information on this, I know that there's not a lot of presentations on this topic on stress, but we're slowly introducing stress to the public health notions because the two are very linked. So just to look at this in a little bit more detail, we tend to underestimate how children can be affected by poverty, because we often say, well, parents are the one who are facing the financial concern that comes with poverty. But in fact, children lack control of that situation. And lack of control is one of the determinants of perceiving stress. So in the case of the children, they're simply exposed to poverty and all the restrictions, and they lack control over that situation. We have talked about the link between childhood poverty and later health. Later health during late childhood, adolescence, and adulthood. One of the pathways that have been suggested is actually, does this work? Yeah. So one of the pathways is stress here to mediate the association between childhood poverty and the adverse effect on health. So in our case, we're going to be talking about cortisol, but there are also other biological measures that you can use to assess stress. So I know that most of you are not too familiar with all the details of how to measure the biology related to stress, so I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this. Here, what you have on the top, and I'm really sorry, but the resolution of the graph is not great. So here, for all the graphs, we have the physiological response to stress. This works for cortisol, it works for blood pressure, it works for every other biological measures that you have. So when you're exposed to stress, your body mounts a response, and normally this is the normal response, and once the stress is over, it's removed, you're supposed to show a recovery and the level goes down. There are a few situations where the response is inadequate, and that would create a burden on your body. And then the main role of that physiological response is to provide energy to face a stressful situation. So when you don't have the correct type of response, then you're not able to face stress in the right way and to adapt. So this is one of the situation. You're exposed to stress, you have an increased response an activity, it goes down once it's done, but then you're facing another type of stressor. It goes up, and then it goes down. And you just keep on facing different kind of stress. So you never really recover, you're never really calm in that situation. Another type of situation is when you're facing the same type of stress, but repeatedly, but then you fail to adapt. Normally, once the first time you see something, you do something, it's novel, you have a stress response, but when you do that several times, you're supposed to be adapting. And the adaptation here, like in the white dots, this is the normal response. Well, the failure to adapt would just result in increase all the time. Another situation is when you mount the correct response, but when the stressor is removed, you don't recover. The level remains high, and then your system is still eventually overactive. And the last type is the one that's the most dangerous, is when you fail to mount any type of response. So your body does not get the energy required to face the stressful situation. So this is the normal. We have the normal on top, and we have the different dysregulation of the system. I'm going to show you one more graph of the biology, just so that we can follow the rest of the presentations, and then we'll be done for the biology part. So this is, cortisol is secreted not just when you're stressed, but you always have that in your body. There's no way of removing it. You always have that, and you always need that. And there are ways in research to measure that without having to stress each person that we see. So we can measure that in collecting the levels at different timing in the day. So for example, in the morning here, in the first hour, in the first half an hour actually after waking up, you can usually measure a cortisol awakening response. This is normal. You're supposed to have a little peak here. And then your normal level is high in the morning. It decreases during the day to the lowest level in the evening, and then at night while you're sleeping, goes back up. So what we measure in research is what you can measure, the response you have in the morning, and also how it decreases during the day. We let the people sleep at night. We don't need to collect any kind of samples. And it makes the whole research area, the collection, easier. So when you're facing moderate stress, all the levels goes up a little bit. But when you're facing chronic stress, the level tends to be blunted. So you barely detect any response in the morning. And also the level during the day is very flat. And this is what these are the two things that we're measuring in this study. So most of the studies on cortisol and child poverty are cross-sectional. I'm going to just show you a few studies, but there's not a lot to start with, but these are the three mains in this topic. So we have Sonia Dupien here in 2000, who had a study with 217 children. They were either 6 years old, 8 years old, or 10. So this is not cross-sectional at each time. It's not longitudinal. And in that large group, everyone with a low SES, which is 96 participant, had elevated morning cortisol. Two other studies were using they had similar or even smaller sample sizes. They also found an association between low SES and elevated cortisol, but at different times. So for example, overnight, or this is a study from Chen, which is the only one that has some longitudinal notion to it. So they looked at low SES at one time point and how cortisol changed in the two following years. So again, low SES and elevated cortisol. And this was done in a pretty small sample. So just as an add-on for those who are familiar with public health, the epidemiology, large sample size, for cortisol studies, you can detect group differences with smaller sample size. So this last study here found an association between SES at one timing and how cortisol changed in the following 2 years. So one of the questions we had in mind is, because most of the studies were cross-sectional, it is hard to look at the effect of a timing of exposure to stress, exposure to severe poverty, on how cortisol would be later on. So that is one of the things we're going to be looking at today. So just as a recap, Studies in cortisol and poverty in children are mostly cross-sectional, and that prevents us to look at the timing of poverty and see if cortisol is affected in childhood. And there are also different measures of poverty that's being investigated in the literature. Most of them looked at income, taking into account the size of the household, where the participant lives, rural or urban, but not that many looked at social welfare, which is a last resort financial aid. And that usually follows prolonged underemployment. So in the stress point of view, they are really facing two different things, to be a working but poor, but still have some sort of control a little bit on that situation, or undergoing a more chronic and severe poverty and stress. So the objective of this study is to look at that, look at the timing of exposure to poverty on the cortisol awakening response in the morning, in the first hour. And we will be looking at that based on two periods. So poverty exposed, the exposure to poverty between birth and 5 years old, and exposure to poverty between 5 years old and 10 years old. And this is where cortisol is going to be measured, just at one time point at 10 years old. So I'm going to be, like we said before, looking at data from the LDEC study. This is the Quebec Longitudinal Study on Child Development. I'm not going to go too much into details because it has already been described before. So we know that at the age of 10 years old, the children were invited to provide health measures, and a subsample of that group provided cortisol measures as well. The cortisol measures was done at home upon awakening and 30 minutes after, and that was twice a week. It was salivary cortisol measures. And they returned the samples by mail, and then from the information we got, we selected the samples that were within 15 minutes of required time. This is really important because we want to really capture the response at 30 minutes. If you delay too much the samples, then you miss out and you don't know if it occurred but you didn't measure it, or there was an absence of response. And we used two measures of poverty. I'm not going to go too much into the details because we have talked about this earlier today. So the LICO, the low income cutoff, and also social welfare, which is the more severe case of poverty. And this is just to remind you the period of timing that we were looking at. So before 5 years old and between 5 and 10 years old. Just a precision here, we're talking about exclusively exposed to those periods. So in period A, for example, the children were exposed before the age of 5 years old, but they were no longer in social welfare for the 5 following years. All right. So we did the analysis using multi-level analysis, and we used all these covariates in the model. So this is what we have, the first set of results, and we have a second one, and then we're done. So the first set of results, this is just to show you how low income and cortisol are associated. So here there's no association, actually. Those who were never exposed to low income had a cortisol awakening response that was not significantly different from those who were exposed at those different timings. It is lower here, but it's not significant. Now, if you look at those who are exposed to social welfare, you can see that the difference is even, it's more pronounced, it's more significant. So again, in green, the first line here are those, the children who were never exposed to social welfare. What we have here in the first column are children who were exposed to social welfare only before the age of 5, and they were no longer exposed between 5 and 10. So they got out of the very severe case, but they still have the lowest response in the morning. And the two other groups have lower, but it's not significantly different. So these are the ones who were exposed to social welfare between 5 and 10, and these were the ones who were randomly exposed to throughout since birth. But we just a caution, we don't have a lot of participants for that one. So then if you want to conclude with that, children living with social welfare before they were 5 years old had a blunted cortisol awakening response at the age of 5, even though they spent 5 years not being social welfare. So as a conclusion, the early exposure to social welfare may be long-lasting and may lead to cortisol dysregulation several years after that severe situation of poverty and stress ended. And the dysregulation pattern is it reflects chronic stress. The different limitations that we have, of course, are attrition and the smaller sample size. But again, in terms of the cortisol kind of research, the small sample size is not a big factor because, yes, you can see the results are really clear. There's a really large difference between those never exposed and those who were exposed before the age of 5. And we did not measure cortisol throughout the rest of the day, but that would have also been an even better indicator of the whole pattern. So just to finish here, just to look at the different implications, what our results implies. So cortisol is a mediator of later physical and psychological health, but that is most of the studies were done in adults. So what about in children? What's the impact of that kind of response? Does it have any functional or clinical impact? Does it affect physical health? Those are the different questions that we're investigating next. Also, we have to keep in mind that children go to school, so does that affect their cognitive performance, school performance? And they're very young, so they still have many years to go with all that development. So those are things that we should look at. Other things that we should look at is that cortisol is part of a cascade of biological events. So cortisol is not alone in there. And we can't say that low-income children have no effect on cortisol. They don't have any problems with their cortisol. We're all fine. They're okay being poor. We should not look at the question that way because perhaps their cortisol is not affected yet, but other measures, other biological measures are affected. And so we should look at how their improved living conditions and other biological measures are during that period of time. All right, so I'm going to stop here. Thank you very much for your attention. If you have any questions, go ahead.
Questions for my up front.
Hi, I'm Jerry Porter, coming from Ohio State University. I'm curious if you found any variation in between like the 2 days of the sample, if between each respondent, if it was, you know, if their curve was the same both days or there was any variability.
Yeah. We use multi-level analysis, so accounting for those 2 days and checking if there's any differences, and there's none. So that's pretty good. But originally, we were maybe expecting some differences because normally your day one is not identical to day two. But we took the measures, both measures were taken on a weekday, while a lot of studies have shown differences between weekend and the weekday. So maybe that's why in this case, even though we had 2 days, they were very similar because the Tuesday, the schedule of your Tuesday is similar to what you have on Thursday or on a Wednesday. So that we have to keep in mind.
Will, Nicholas, UCLA, I'm interested in a similar conclusion on the force of the period effect, but compared to the last presentation as well, but there was a different kind of analysis, right? In the previous one, you used a latent class growth analysis. You actually track trajectories over time, and in your case, it was more about like you had kind of, you classified different variables earlier versus later. So I'm wondering if you tried both types of analyses to see if they corroborate.
We tried to be consistent, but the sample size did not allow us to do that because we had. I thought it was more important to clean the data and to keep those who respected the time of data collection, but that reduced our numbers to a lot smaller than what Louise had. She had 1,000, and then I'm kind of, I won't say stuck, but I ended up with 445. And that, because of that, those who were chronically poor, we had such a small number that we couldn't measure that. So it's flip the question around and then look at the timing instead of looking at the accumulation.
Yeah.
Well, social. Actually, I didn't show you part of the results. I tried to look at the number of times the children were exposed to social welfare, and by grouping them as less than three or more than three, well, actually zero, so never exposed, one or two, so within the first 10 years of life, so they kind of managed to recover, and then more than three. those were the only categories I managed to form to have decent sample size in there. And for that, for those who have, were exposed to more than three, the level is slightly higher overall. But it's not as blunted as what I'm showing you here. But the level, you start to see some sort of dysregulation in their system. But I guess it would be more interesting if we looked at other biological markers as well so that we can assess that.
Just one more question, and hopefully I'll have time at the end. Yeah.
Well, we don't have the food stamp. We have food banks, but that's more on a voluntary basis. And there's no way to know whether they actually go or not. What I've heard from just as an anecdote is that before you actually voluntarily go there, you have to be in a really, really bad situation. So a lot of people either deny, try to find other ways to work it out, and when it really does not work, then they actually go there. So for the nutrition part, I don't know. I guess in the study there are a few questions about related to obesity and what type of food they eat and all. And I think there is one question about enough money to cover basic needs, for example, food and shelter. But that's very vague. It's not exactly what they eat and how it works inside their body. So that would be an asset in addition to the study.
Thank you, Mai.